If you want this podcast free of ads, follow us now on patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
What's the crack? It is podcast time. The sun is out. It is tropical out here in Dunleary. John, how are you, my man?
It's going to be tropic.
It's tropic and all. it's wonderful, but we're going to stick with the weather, but we're going to look at the environment. We're going to look at climate change because this week, if you've been watching the news, you'll see in Canada, parts of the United States, temperatures going through the roof. You'll see in London, in Brussels, in Germany, you'll see a huge flooding. Dozens of people dead, many hundreds feared dead, missing. We know that climate change is not only on its way, it's here now. It's here now. And yet we prevaricate. John, I know you've been an environmentalist well before it was ever discussed.
That's
your thing.
That's my degree.
I know.
I did a degree in environmental science. And even back then, you hear the same old arguments now, the same old climate deniers. I said it before, I think on one of our live shows, that climate change deniers should be treated the same as Holocaust deniers. Because I think it is as important, as deadly as the Holocaust was, not belittling the Holocaust in any sort of way, but millions of people. It's interesting, actually. I was just reading a Sky News. I'm not a huge fan of Sky News, but sometimes they do really brilliant reports.
Yep.
And they've a whole series of climate change reports at the moment. Well, here's just one fact. I'm just going to pull out this one fact. In 2020... more than 1,770 weather-related events led to more than 30 million new displacements around the world.
Of people.
That is shocking. I mean, you know, you never...
I know, and you're saying large or small. It could be a small event with like a family moving or groups of individuals moving.
Yeah,
But it's constantly...
But it's because of the weather. You know, in California, for instance, 1 million people were displaced. You know, a Western society, you'd never expect to have refugees, and you have 1 million of them in the West Coast of America. But in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, is the fastest growing city at the moment. And it's the fastest growing city because a third of the country, pretty much a third of the country, is a floodplain. It's a delta.
Yeah.
So it gets flooded every year, but the flooding is getting worse and worse and worse.
And the people are moving to Dhaka.
People are moving to Dhaka.
Imagine what's going to happen.
2,000 a day or something like that.
Imagine what's going to happen when those people move from Bangladesh into Pakistan, into India.
China, Myanmar, the whole lot.
We should not ever forget that since the foundation of the state of Pakistan, the state of India, and later the state of Bangladesh, which used to be known as East Pakistan, there have been numerous wars. And all those wars, although people believe them to be over ethnicity and religion, they're actually over resources.
Yeah.
Right? And of course, the biggest one is water.
Is water.
And
yeah.
I tell you, last year...
It's ironic we're talking about flooding, you know?
Well, it's funny. I was in a place in India. I went to the most holy city for the Indians.
Varanasi.
Exactly.
Yes.
On the Ganges.
Yeah.
And I asked them all, and of course they believe in this holistic sense of the Ganges and whatever, but the Ganges rises in the Himalayas, yeah. right? And of course, what is happening in the Himalayas is the Chinese are diverting the water away from India into China at the very top,
yeah.
leading to what could be clearly the most dangerous resource war, which is between China and India, because the Ganges plain is the breadbasket of India. It's what feeds India.
Yeah.
And when you're in Varanasi, you get that sense of the river, the fragility of people and river and agriculture and weather and the flow of water. Anyway, we could talk about this for hours.
It goes on and on. And the other big one is the River Jordan as well in the Middle East.
Yes.
That's another...
Where the Israelis are diverting the water.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You could end up with stuff, you know... You know, we've seen it happen before in the Aral Sea, in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. You know, that was a sea pretty much the size of Leinster, and it's now kind of disappeared.
Well,
so you have these fishing trawlers, literally 100 miles from
the
water.
I know. Well, there's another one in Russia called Lake Baikal, which is right in the middle, and that again, if you look at the sea levels. And I'm talking going back to the 60s, not hundreds of years ago, but not that long ago. And you just see the various different notches where the sea levels.
Baikal is a particularly interesting lake because it has its own unique ecosystem. It is the clearest and cleanest water, freshwater in the world. It's one of the deepest freshwater lakes, but it has its own species of seals, freshwater seals.
I told you. Deep down, I can tell you, when John was a kid, he used to come over to my house. We were about 7 or 8. And I would be watching football and reading Shoot, right? The great magazine.
Shoot, yeah.
Okay? Where footballers would always give their favourite meal, which was always scampi and chips. So I used to ask my mom to make scampi and chips for us. And she didn't know what scampi was. But John would come over with animal track books about tracks and animals and the environment and all that. And fascinatingly, I was behind the curve and he was well ahead of the curve. But what I want
not
to talk...
Not the only thing,
Mike. I know, that's true. But what I want to talk now, John, there's a great economist called Professor Steve Keen, an iconoclast from Australia. He has been chipping away at the role of economics. I mean, he really feels that economics and economists are not the cause of, but are part of the problem when it comes to giving advice, not only about climate change, but lots of other stuff. He's in Bangkok. He is a brilliant mind, and he's got a lot of things to say about the role of economics and economists in making things not better, but much, much worse. So let's go to Bangkok. Now we have a special, special conversation coming up with Professor Steve Keen. Every single discipline needs somebody to go against the consensus. Every discipline. And in fact, I don't know who it was. Somebody very intelligent said, you only get to the top of your game once you reject your peer group and you escape the tyranny of the peer group. And economics, believe me, we can go into it, Steve and I, and actually we won't, but economics has been dominated by the tyranny of the peer group for a long, long time. So much so that some of even the basic ideas don't stand up to even the most remote bar stool curiosity or questioning of whether or not they reflect reality. Now, Steve Keen has been chipping away for a long, long time, also using mathematics, using really heavy data stuff in order to fight the battle against economics mainstreams and economic consensus in their own backyard. Okay? He is on the line. He's a Kilkenomics delinquent recidivist. He's on the line from Bangkok. Steve, how are you?
Mate, I'm very well and great to hear your voice once more. It's been too long since the last Talkonomics.
Yeah, well, listen, you know, when we can all get out to play, we'll see what happens this year. We're still toying with the idea of going ahead, going not ahead. But look, let's see how it goes. You know, the last thing you want to be doing is packing 1,000 people into a cathedral and then suddenly somebody hits the alarm bell and we all have to split. And But we'll figure it out. Steve, I want to ask you straight away about climate change and economics, right? Mm-hmm. Explain to me why you think by looking at climate change, you can really evidence how much economists get wrong.
Oh, I have to say that, like you said, I've been doing this for a long time. It's actually 50 years that I can date since I first became a critic of economics. In fact, it's almost today, because it was in the middle of July of 1971 in a first-year economics lecture that I had explained to me what's called the theory of the second best. And that drove a hole through the usual arguments against trade unions and against monopolies. Anyway, so 50 years of that. I have never read anything as bad in the 50 years I've been a critic as the work I've seen by neoclassical economists who specialised in climate change, especially the guy that gave a Nobel Prize to in 2018, William Nordhaus. And the reason is, let's assume a can opener. You know that old joke?
Go for it.
Okay. You got a physicist and a chemist and an economist get wrecked on a desert island, and a container load of baked beans floats up, and that's all they've got to eat. And the chemist says, "Well, I can start a fire with those palm fronds over there and blow the cans up." And the physicist said, "Well, if you do that, I can work out the trajectory of the beans, and we can go and eat them." And the economist says, "Oh, I mean, you're doing it too hard. Just assume we have a can opener."
Okay, right. Now, so you're going from the impractical to the hyper-impractical.
Hyper-impractical. And this is what Nordhaus did. Now, he just goes to the chase. Of course, there's thousands of scientific papers about the damages of – tens of thousands about the damages of climate change. And I naively thought that what Nordhaus has done is take some of those and apply a high discount rate to them. I was wrong. What he did was he simply assumed that anything happening indoors would be unaffected by climate change.
Indoors.
Okay. 87% of industry he ruled out as being unaffected of climate change because it occurs in, quote unquote, carefully controlled environments. And literally all of manufacturing, all of services, wholesale, retail, all of government activity, everything that, and even mining. You see, he obviously wasn't thinking about open cut mining, thinking about underground mining. He said all those industries will be negligibly affected by climate change. And he couldn't see any way they'd be affected in the next 50 to 75 years. This is writing back in 1990.
So because things happen indoors irrespective of what the outside temperature is this what he was saying? This stuff will not be affected by climate change and will continue to go on as is. Now, what you're highlighting, Steve, is that once you begin to assume away reality, your models your models are no longer simulations of what might happen in the real world, but they're just kind of bullshit.
They're fantasies, total fantasies. And this is what I found. And like it was, it actually, it wasn't the first thing I found. I'll give you an anecdote here. The first I found was reading a paper by a guy called Richard Toll, who's one of the cabal of economists who works with Nordhaus. I really think cabal's a pretty good, you know, coven might be a useful term as well. They think so alike. They might have been reading their scripts from the same playbook. But he said that one of the way they worked out numbers on what damage climate change would do to the economy was by doing empirical work now on the relationship between income in one particular location on the planet and temperature, and then using that to predict what's going to happen with climate change. And because they found a weak relationship between temperature and income today, they predict a weak impact of climate change on the economy. And that literally goes to the stage where Nordhaus in 2018, after he got the Nobel Prize, in an American Economic Review journal, published a prediction that a 6-degree increase in global temperatures would reduce GDP by less than 10% compared to what it would have been in the complete absence of climate change.
Now, 6% will burn us alive. We'll be gone.
6 degrees, we would be extinct. Okay. Degrees is enough to wipe out most mammals. And of course, we eat the mammals, we rely upon them, and fish. If a billion humans survived that'd be a miracle. Okay. And it wouldn't be a particularly enjoyable miracle.
Let's get down to brass tacks. It's always struck me about economic models. And I don't want to go on about economic models, even though it's an economics podcast, because even my eyes glaze over when I talk about them. But you know the way you see pilots will train in a simulation hub. And that simulation will say, you know what, if you hit a huge storm in the middle of the Atlantic, this is what to expect, okay? We will, and that's how you simulate reality. And that is very worthwhile and very useful for a pilot. If the simulations and models bear no reality to everyday life, then ultimately the models are not only wrong, but they're actually really misleading.
They're dangerous.
Okay.
They're purely dangerous is the word. And what economists have done, and this is something you and I have been saturated with, is the argument that assumptions don't matter. Economists will throw this at you all the time. It comes from Milton Friedman in 1953, an argument called the methodology of positive economics. And what he argued in that was that, in fact, rather than being able to criticize in a theory because of its assumptions, he said the more unrealistic the assumptions, the better the theory.
Wow.
And the idea...
Okay. And that's another Nobel Prize winner.
That's another Nobel Prize winner. Now, what he was doing was telling people, if you have to know the literature to know this, telling people don't read empirical articles in the American Economic Review telling you that firms don't face rising marginal costs. Because, you know, the whole upward sloping supply curve, downward sloping demand curve stuff that economists go on about. An essential part of that is the idea that it costs more to produce extra units of output because your productivity falls as you add more workers to production. Now, when empirical researchers went out and checked that, they found, well, that's not the case. In fact, the firms seem to get more efficient as they get to higher and higher levels of capacity. And see, Friedman said, don't bother reading that stuff. It's like asking a pool player how they sink a pool ball. They'll tell you because they rub a rabbit's foot beforehand. It doesn't matter. They must be obeying the laws of mathematics to do this, which assumes, you know, rising marginal cost, blah, blah, blah. And in fact, there's a very good reason why that is wrong. It makes plenty of sense that firms get more efficient as they move towards full production because they're designed by engineers, not by economists. But anyway, that became their way out. Whenever anybody criticized an economist, they'd say, oh, you can't criticize the assumptions. We have to make simplifying assumptions. These are not simplifying assumptions. If this assumption is wrong, the theory is wrong. And that's what you and I are talking about.
And then the model will predict wrong. And if you base everything on the model, you'll actually go off on a wild goose chase in the wrong direction.
You'll end up diving into the Sargasso Sea in your simulation.
Let us talk about climate change, okay? Mm. Even this week, yeah, all around the world, we're seeing evidence of an increasing with alacrity of events that are pointing in one direction. What can we do about climate change? What can economics do? And can we affect proper climate change policies in democracies that are open, that are, you know, kind of messy and nudgy and all that sort of stuff? What do you think?
We could have 50 years ago if we'd followed the advice of the Limits to Growth. And the Limits to Growth told us that we live in a finite planet. There are constraints, not just in terms of we might run out of resources, but if you use too much of resources, you'll generate too much pollution, which will cut back on your productivity, et cetera, et cetera. The pollution will damage your food generation and so on. And using all that, those feedback effects, they said that on the current trajectory, they took data from 1900 to 1970 and then extrapolated that through what's called a system dynamics program through to 2100 and basically said between 2020 and 2050, we're going to run into some serious stuff in terms of survivability of the planet unless we reduce our trajectory now. And if we'd followed that advice 50 years ago, we could have done it gradually, we could have done it democratically. We didn't, and one of the major reasons we didn't was economists trashed that analysis without properly understanding it. And I have to say this, the economist who did most to trash them was William Nordhaus.
Our Nobel Prize winner.
This man's fingerprints are all over everything from 50 years ago.
Okay, well, let's leave Nordhaus aside for a second, okay?
Yeah.
And let's talk about climate change right now.
Yeah.
So I'm reading about the European Commission, European Union saying we want to get to a zero carbon moment in 2030. 2030 is 8 years away, in effect.
Yeah.
What needs to be done in a democratic, and I keep going back to this democratic society, okay, where people vote, self-interest, prevarication, all these things. What can be done now to make that possible?
Yeah, the problem is that and I think this is a general thing. I'm not going to criticize economists here, but I'm going to criticize humans instead. We never change direction until after what we're doing collapses around us. So the ordinary person is not going to accept, just like a lot of people don't accept that COVID even exists, that I think the COVID deniers have gone, but the COVID trivializers are still with us. And all this stuff, as we've seen how badly it's affected our capacity to respond to COVID, And I think the same thing applies with climate change. People will not take it seriously until things like what's happening in Germany right now and California and Canada start happening so wide. People say, what the hell's going on? And then realizing that this is actually life-threatening. So I'm afraid that's, I think what has to happen, particularly in a democratic society, unfortunately, is people will only accept we have to do something drastic when it becomes clearly life-threatening. And I think this is the decade that's going to happen. Now, okay, the question is, can we get out of our reaction? I'm not really sure.
Well, I mean, if you think of COVID, Steve, COVID had a profound change in behavior of the whole world from the top down. We actually did manage in democratic societies to say, hold on, this is an existential threat. Maybe not to everybody, but to our health system, which is sufficiently important to us. And we did change behavior. So there
we did fairly well. I mean, I've got an ambivalent feeling about COVID overall. There are, like, the gold star has to go to New Zealand, and that really comes down to a politician, Jacinda Ardern, and a strong social bond in New Zealand, and they've kept it out, permanently. And Taiwan as well has done pretty well. So you can do it, and then even as bad as it's been done in the UK, you've still got, you know, the vaccine rollout's been reasonably effective. So we have done some effective countering of it. But it was, again, the warnings about this being a possibility occurred as long ago as 1995. Now, what was America doing and the UK doing in 2018? They were dismantling their protections against a pandemic. Trump actually bragged about it was okay to sack all those people from the Center for Disease Control because he can hire them again when necessary. Well, that worked well. UK's minister was asked how many masks should they have in reserve. The answer from the scientists was 1 billion. Oh, that's too many. Let's put 50 million in reserve. Well, they went out in 2 days.
I'm talking to Professor Steve Keen. What you don't see is we're talking on Zoom, and behind him is a sort of a little magical performance by a pair of cats who are jumping up and down. And they look fantastic, and they're adding to the ambience of the conversation. Steve, what do we have to do? Let's talk about climate change.
Yeah.
Do we have to dramatically reduce economic output, production, etc. right now in order bear down on carbon consumption in order to get us somewhere?
Yes, I believe we do. We simply can't do it by growing more carefully. We can't grow. We have to shrink the economy. And that shrinkage, of course, has to be the burden of that shrinking has to fall on the wealthy and not on the poor. That's the only way I can see it.
So let's talk about this. How does this materialize in the next decade? Because this is the big question. We can talk about, you know, economists get worried about inflation, things like relax. That's chicken feed, right? Let's talk about climate change.
Well, what I came up with, and I found someone had actually beaten me to the idea, was carbon rationing. And the concept was that we have a price system right now where if you've got money, you can buy something. If you don't have money, you can't buy something. We need to not control not money. We need to control carbon. So my idea was to have the central bank build a digital currency through which it would distribute a universal carbon credit on a per capita basis. So you'd get exactly the same carbon allowance that Rupert Murdoch gets.
Okay.
Now, and then whenever you bought something, it would have two prices, a money price and a carbon price. Now, of course, if you then set that at the average for a country, you and I might just exceed it, but 90%, 95% of the population would not use the universal carbon credits. So therefore, they'd have some to sell. And the rich, the Richard Bransons of the world, let's use a very apposite example recently, would have a huge need to buy universal carbon credits off the poor. So this would be a way of rationing carbon while putting the burden of adjustment on the rich and letting the poor benefit from the process.
I like that idea. I do like that idea. So the rich countries, let's say Western Europe, United States, Oz, New Zealand, for one, are using enormous amounts of carbon. We're flying all over the place. We're buying stuff, et cetera, et cetera. The poorer countries, let's take your African countries, your Kenyas of this world, are not using it. So basically, we would be charged for our excessive consumption of carbon. We would pay them, and they would do what?
Well, it's actually thinking of doing it at the national level, because one thing, again, I'm very conscious of is a good way to stop something happening is to require an international agreement for it to occur.
Yeah, you don't want to be doing that.
The, the waffle that goes on at these damn things. I mean, you know, and it's all bureaucrats and large documents and all the nonsense. That's the COP26 will be the same, I expect, though maybe what's happening in Germany will put some urgency to it. But if you can do it at the national level, and you make it something which is beneficial to 90 to 95% of the population, that I think it's feasible. So my idea of a universal carbon credit, carbon rationing, and the website that I'm now associated with is called carbonrationing.org. You could do that at the national level tomorrow and yes. say, okay, digital currency, every day you're going to get a UCC allowance from the central bank. You 90% will, if we set it at the average, because of such a skewed distribution of income and wealth in society, the average is what 95% of people consume less than.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you set it at that level, only the top 5% would be actually running out of carbon credits and have to buy off the poor. That'd put enormous pressure on them to stop buying, you know, diesel fueled and gas fueled stuff and go over to electric. So that's one motivation there. The poor would benefit by getting money out of it. And you'd, I think, a strong pressure to reduce it at the national level. And then you could take that national to the international scene when it became obvious that we have to do it a damn sight faster than even that scheme would do.
No, you know, because I like that, because basically it's a wealth tax, it's an environmental yep. tax, and it's an equilibrium or an equalizing measure.
It's an equalizer.
Yeah, okay. I like this idea, and that's on the consumption side, right? What fascinates me is I was down in the west of Ireland the other day, and at the moment the weather is quite good, but a couple of weeks ago it wasn't very, very good. I was looking at the waves and I was feeling the wind at my face. And I was thinking to myself, there's only four real renewables. There's wind, wave, solar, and geothermal. These are these are our natural ways, power and stuff. For the last 100 years, the Dubais or the United Arab Emirates or the Saudis of this world were the source of all energy. Would it be feasible that northwestern Europe, remote islands in the northwest of Europe, could actually become the Saudi Arabia of the renewable world?
This is one thing which I have a lot of engineers on my Patreon site, and there are sort of two major camps. There's pro-nuclear and pro-renewables.
Okay.
And I'm finding myself torn between the two. The nuclear mob say that the energy density of renewables is too low, and the resource need to generate all that stuff, in particularly in terms of solar cells, that you know the rare earths you have to use, ditto inside magnets for wind farms and so on. We face resource constraints in that direction as well. The nuclear mobs say, well, the density of nuclear power is so much higher than oil, so much higher. A piece of thorium you could hold in your hand would give you enough energy for 200 years as an individual consumer. So they say the energy density of nuclear is higher. Now, and they're also telling me that the safety issues we used to worry about are dramatically lower than they were 30, 40, 50 years ago with old nuclear power design. So I'm torn between the two. I respect engineers a damn sight more than I respect economists. They tend to factionalize nonetheless.
Of course they do. All tribes get very jealous and turn into factions. But go on.
So I think it's feasible to do both. But the speed at which we'd need to do it is something scary. The rate at which we'd need to do this to decarbonize is huge, because when you look at the levels that renewables are providing of total energy consumption right now, it's about 15%. And most of that is still the old-fashioned hydro. Even though we were rolling out solar and wind very quickly, it's got a long, long way to go. And you'd need to have the rate of growth of solar and wind increase by a factor of about 6 to 8 from what I've seen to get to the stage where by 2050 we could have total renewables, let alone 2030.
I'm telling you what, I'm looking at a glittering city in the sky in the west of Ireland, powered by renewables, powered by wind wave. No, but it is interesting because countries need to be thinking this way. What are we going to do in the next 100 years? How are we going to play our part? Do we have any natural energy and renewable sources? And if we do, use them. Go and use them.
Yeah, we've got to do that. I think we've also got to reduce our load on the planet in general, because it's a mistake just to focus upon carbon dioxide and temperature. Okay? We're doing far more damage to the biosphere than just those two. What we're doing to biodiversity is scary. The rate at which we're causing species to go extinct. And by the way, on that front, economists are an absolute, Sorry, I get sarcastic. I lose my track on sarcastic thoughts occasionally. But one of the so-called experts that Nordhaus consulted was an economist who said that in talking about the economic damages from climate change, he didn't worry about the existence of ants. He didn't care about ants except for drugs. Well, I'm sorry. Just like COVID doesn't care about our democracy, the biosphere doesn't care about what we think about it. If we knock out ants, we'll die. It's part of the web of life. So it's more than just the carbon we need to think about. And we've gone far too far. We have to pull back. Even if it was only even if we had carbon under control, we'd still need to pull back on how much we're intruding upon the biosphere.
Steve, can I just conclude? This is great, fascinating stuff. We could talk, we have done late at night all about economics and all sorts of carry on. And we're definitely going to come back because I want to talk to you about the economics of money. I want to talk to you about MMT. I want to talk to you about constraints. I want to talk to you about really reimagining and rewiring our brains as economists to actually rid ourselves of some of the nonsense we've inherited over the last, in your case, 50, in my case, 30 years. Okay. But let's just come back to a final thought. Okay. Do we now need to wriggle free of the influence of traditional economics on policymaking across a significant number of sectors in order to see the light?
Yeah, we've got to get rid of economists. Period. Okay.
See, John's laughing his hole off over here.
They've got to go. The final, I've got a new book coming out, as you know, in October called The New Economics, The Manifesto. And I'm talking about neoclassical economics, but the final line is it has to go. And I'm like, as I said, we chatted away saying Noah Smith once accused me of wanting to drive a purge. He's right. I want to purge the world of neoclassical economists because the damage they've done to our capacity to understand not just climate change, but the economy as well, which we're going to go on to next, is enormous. And we've been trying to shift them. I've been trying for 50 years. Other critics have been trying. You can go back to Hobson and the Confessions of an Economic Heretic back at the end of the 19th century. Veblen. We're all been saying this stuff is nonsense. Let's get rid of it. But it's so invasive. It's the classic invasive species. You got to wipe it out.
Steve Keen, I will talk to you soon. Got to wipe it out. I'm getting nervous. John here, he's got his pitchfork. He's out of the thatch. The revolution
the
begins.
The pitchforks are coming.
Steve, that was great stuff. Listen, talk to you soon.
Okay, mate. Will do.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Good stuff from Steve.
You know, I could listen to that kind of stuff, although I was tearing my hair out. You know, the people like your man, Nordhaus and stuff.
He's really looked forensically at the Nordhaus stuff. And Nordhaus has a lot of disciples. He mentioned a guy called Richard Tall, who was knocking around here in Dublin for quite some time.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but that's a different story. Sinn Scéal Ella.
Right.
But what do you make of it all?
Well, what I thought at the end when he talked about the web of life, we've spoken a few times before about the evolution of economics.
Yep.
And economics being some class of an ecosystem. And it's very true because it's an ecosystem, not just with supply chains and producers and manufacturers and buyers and, consumers. It also is an ecosystem that includes the environment and resources. So every economic activity is an environmental activity. And I thought that was really... But one of my favorite quotes that David Attenborough said at one stage, I can't remember where he said it, but he said, "The only people who believe that economic growth can continue indefinitely are, number one, lunatics, and number two, economists." That's you, man. That's you.
That's me. Well, I tell you what, we'll leave it at this image, though, which is, you know, this... the idea of the irresistible force crashing into the immovable object, right?
Yeah.
And that's when you get, so you've got the irresistible force of 7 or 8 billion consumers in the world, not just people, right? Wanting to consume, right? And being encouraged to consume by the economic side of the equation, right? Smashing into the unmovable object of the Earth's finite resources. The thing about the Earth, you can't get any bigger. The resources are finite.
It is what it is.
And that's the story of the next decade, John. So what we're going to do, we started with Steve. Let's keep exploring environmental economics, the environment, resources, resource wars, where our obsession with growth smashes into this idea of a precious world with finite resources. And let's look at that. Let's make that a topic for the next couple of months.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, there you go. We're going to get all green on you. Talk to you soon. Just a quick note to say thank you to all our Patreon supporters. And if you fancy supporting us on Patreon, you can check us out at patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.